What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
Were you a failure at the one most important personal relationship in your life?
It did not succeed.
Not it, Mrs. Kramer. You. Were you a failure at the one most important relationship in your life? Were you?
Oh, the 70s. That's Meryl Streep on the witness stand in 1979's Kramer vs. Kramer. Streep's Joanna Kramer, one of many complicated movie moms from the me decade.
You know, I was only, between 1 and 6 at the time, but I did recognize that it was a complicated time, Adam. This week, in honor of Mother's Day, we've got our top 5 70s movie moms.
We had 70s moms ourselves, as you suggested, so we are in a position to judge. Along with that top 5, we continue our 7 from 76 Best Year Ever series with Chantel Ackerman's News from Home.
That and more ahead on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. So hopefully this Mother's Day weekend, Josh, we've got the moms taken care of. Top 5 70s movie moms is our list. We will get to that here in a moment. Belgian filmmaker Chantel Ackerman's loving ode to her mom, News from Home. We'll talk about that. But what have we got for the dads out there? Or, you know, for the moms who like movies with Jason Statham punching and shooting stuff?
Yeah, my mom enjoyed the action film from time to time. Podcast listeners, you can hear my thoughts on Wrath of Man. I don't know if she would have enjoyed Wrath of Man, though. Adam, I'm also going to have a quick review of Swedish auteur Roy Anderson's latest About Endlessness. That comes later in the show. Radio listeners, you can always find the full show at filmspotting.net or wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's jump into our top 5 70s movie moms with a question. In a list of the top movie moms of all time, Pantheon movie moms, maybe Mary Astor in Meet Me in St. Louis, Holly Hunter, her Helen Parr from The Incredibles, Frances McDormand's Lane Miller, and Almost Famous, any number of Marmies in the Little Women adaptations. Does any 70s movie mom make the list for you, Josh, even crack the top 50?
Well, it wasn't easy. I will say that. I think I have one that might crack the top 50, though. We'll see when we get to it.
Okay. So using the criterion there that wasn't necessarily the criterion for our list and really probably couldn't have been for this 70s movie mom list, warmth, caring, compassion, good moms, Josh. But You don't have to be a good mom to be a really interesting mom, at least hopefully, for our list. Now, why are we doing this? We are in the middle of a 7 from 76 Best Year Ever series. Taxi Driver, Rocky, All the President's Men, Network, not a lot of moms to be found there. We are also looking ahead to next year's Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s. We talked about Hal Ashby's Shampoo. That was a blind spot for both of us for a recent bonus episode that went out to family members over on Patreon. Lee Grant's Felicia, I don't think she's going to make the cut, Josh.
I don't know that she's aware she is a mom, actually.
Maybe not. The 70s were indeed a tough decade for movie moms. Let's find out just how tough putting together this list was for you, Josh.
You know, I took on the challenge, Adam. In honor of Mother's Day, I wanted to be as positive as I could. And I thought, I've got to be able to find 5 admirable movie moms here. And I think I did it. It took a little homework. It took, yes, some homework. It took maybe finding some more obscure characters, especially we'll see here with my number 5. It was also, though, I found, you know, a helpful way to narrow down the list. It gave me simple criteria. Sure. I just said, yeah, those qualities you listed, but also characters you'd want as your mom. You know, if you had this character as your mom, you'd be doing pretty okay. And I we'll see. You may not agree, but I think I managed to pull it off.
All right, let's hear it. You're number 5.
All right. So yeah, this narrow criteria, it did open the door to some obscure options, and that is what I've got here. It is Preach's mom, played by Mary Larkins, in 1975's Cooley High. So this was part of our 2012 Blaxploitation Marathon. Adam, I don't know if you'll even remember Preach's mom. I think you'll remember the scene, though, that I want to talk about. She is a character who is not even given a name in the credits, at least at imdb.com. Certainly doesn't have a big part in the film. But as I started running 1970s titles through my mind, she jumped out because of this crucial, really lovely scene that speaks exactly to her character being a mom. First, though, quick reminder for those who didn't follow along with us on that marathon, Cooley High stars Glenn Turman. He was so good recently as the piano player in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, much younger here, as he plays Preach, a Chicago teen who ditches school, runs around the city with his friends, gets into trouble. There's a lot of fun youth movie energy to this. And interestingly, Adam, it's directed by Michael Schultz, who also made Car Wash, which is coming up in our 7 from 76 series. So this is a fun movie, but it's also realistic about the challenges facing those in the neighborhood where Preach and his friends live. And this includes nods to the single mothers who are working multiple jobs. Now, as for Preach's mom, there's this scene where she gets home. She's just home from a night shift, and she has to deal with Preach. He's been out late, getting into more trouble. She comes in anger and exasperation. She just orders him to bring her a belt. She plans to give him a whipping. While she's sitting at the table, though, waiting for him to come back, she's so exhausted that she just falls asleep right there in her chair, nods off within seconds. Preach comes back into the room, finds her sleeping, and just gives her this gentle kiss. It's just this quick, quiet exchange between them. It's a throwaway moment in the film, really, but I found it incredibly touching. And I think it captures why Preach's mom is the sort of mom we want. Someone who's not going to abandon the job, the responsibility, unless they literally, physically cannot do it anymore. Now, obviously, we don't want a whipping to be part of that job, but I do think the commitment to parenting to the point of sheer exhaustion is what this scene really captures. So That's Mary Larkins as Preach's mom in Cooley High.
Yeah, that's a great pick. That movie ended up being maybe a bit of a surprise for both of us as one of the standout films from that marathon. I was looking back at my notes. We had Odie Henderson, who writes for RogerEbert.com, as sort of a consultant for that lineup. And he talked about this movie, for those of you who maybe haven't seen it and are curious, as a black answer to American Graffiti. It was Motown, though, instead of doo-wop music. And the writer, Eric Monte, wrote the TV show Good Times, which I watched incessantly as a kid. Just looking it up real quick, that aired between 1974 and 79. Don't think I was watching it during those years. Definitely watched it on reruns then in the early 80s. A couple other notes here before I dive into my list. The movie Chinatown, I don't know if you would have considered Faye Dunaway's character or not. Yes, a little icky. Mm-hmm. Can we say that?
Yeah. But
that certainly wasn't her choice, and there's no reason to think that she is not potentially a wonderful mother. Chinatown, though, in the Pantheon, so it's off limits for top five lists. And then we did, speaking of Chantal Ackerman, we did decide to put Jean Dielman in the penalty box, not eligible for this list, just because otherwise I think it would have been a very obvious pick for this top five list, and we've talked about that movie a lot, and it deserves all that talk and acclaim because that film from 1975 is a masterpiece, but again, won't make this list. Your criterion I love. I did not use it, so we'll have a nice point counterpoint here. I think your word was admirable. Maybe I went a little more eccentric.
Okay.
And I'm not sure that if you look at my list, you'll really find more than 1.5 moms, maybe, who you'd really want as your mom. I'm setting the over-under
okay.
at 1.5, Josh. We'll see how I do as I go through my picks. My number five, speaking of Hal Ashby and the movie Shampoo, is Harold and Maude, Mrs. Chasen. And I will preface everything here by saying that I don't really remember when I last saw Harold and Maude. I plan to watch it again, not just because it's surely going to make our Film Spotting Madness 1970s list next year, but we have talked about doing a 50-year anniversary review of the movie here on the show, but it will feel probably like the first time to me. One of the things I'm really eager to consider is how much I feel for Mrs. Chasen. And I equate it maybe to another movie we revisited in recent years and a mom we referenced off the top of the show, Elaine Miller and Almost Famous, that Cameron Crowe movie. Didn't we spend some time on the fact that kind of when you watch that when you're younger And we were both in our early 20s when that movie came out. So it's not like we were young kids. And it's not that Elaine Miller is a villain per se, but you definitely see her as a little oppressive. You're rooting for William to be let out from under her thumb. And then you find that the older you get, especially if you have been raising kids, you watch Almost Famous again, and you see Elaine as way more relatable and sympathetic. And here with Harold and Maude, Harold, of course, is our hero. He's rebelling against this stuffy, snobbish upbringing, this prescribed, surely phony existence. We love all the pranks. We love all the ways. He's pushing back on his mom. And then, well, maybe middle-aged us will watch this movie and think about how exhausting that would all be to manage, and perhaps think about even how much she probably does truly care about her son and only want what's best for him, even if she doesn't show it properly. Well, how often do we all as parents fall short in that regard too, Josh? So she was on my mind, and then Michael Green, a listener in Dover, Delaware, clinched it for me. He said, I just had a great blind spotting viewing experience with Harold and Maude from 1971. My pick for this week's top five 70s moms would be Mrs. Chasen, played marvelously by Vivian Pickles. She's so indifferent and aloof to Harold. You want to feel bad for her that her son puts her through the fake suicides and blind date fiascos, but she brings it on herself. Every move she seems to make, Harold has a counter move that is better. Case in point is the hilarious reveal of Harold's sports car role model as she brings one of his blind dates and finds it to be a hearse instead of a sports car. She's great, her reactions are great, and the movie is great. Excited to hear your picks. Thank you for that, Michael. I do think that's it, ultimately. Whether you do truly sympathize with Mrs. Chasen or not, it is the humor that makes her special, that makes her one of the standout moms of the 70s. Yes, it's that aloofness Michael alluded to, the persistence. And maybe in that persistence, Josh, there is love in there. Misguided, perhaps, but probably love.
Did you enjoy life when you were a child? Oh, yes, you were a wonderful baby, Harold. Do you think the sexual revolution has gone too far? It certainly has. Do you find the idea of wife swapping distasteful? I even find the question distasteful.
Maybe my favorite line in the movie and my favorite line delivery is that one going through the dating questionnaire, answering all the questions on Harold's behalf. And the question comes up about, I think, wife swapping. Do you find it distasteful? And she says, I even find the question distasteful.
What's fascinating about Mrs. Chasen to me is just, you know, making a generalization here about the generations. We tend to talk about being raised in the 70s as kind of the time of free range parenting. You know, mm-hmm. I think this has been our shared experience, right? You open the front door, get out, come back when you're hungry or when we call you.
Parents really had no clue.
Right. Well, yeah, pretty much. And today it seems very much like, you know, parents are right on top of their kids for every moment, exactly like Mrs. Chasen is presented. So here we think about the 70s as this other style of parenting, and she's what people are being described as today. So she's kind of out of time in a way, maybe, mm-hmm. let's say, Mrs. Chasen.
Do you have ups and downs without obvious reason? That's you, Harold.
All right, your number four, 1970s movie mom.
My number four is Charlotte A. Kavatica, voiced by Debbie Reynolds in Charlotte's Web. I'm just stealing this one. Straight up stealing it. I'm going to admit it. It was a brilliant, unconventional pick that was mentioned by a couple of listeners on social media. Dustin Markell on Twitter and Aaron Bergstrom on my Larson on Film Facebook page. So this is the 1973 animated adaptation of the great E.B. White children's book. It comes from the Hanna-Barbera studio. Speaking of things we watched at that time, Adam, so much 70s stuff from my youth came from them. Super Friends, Scooby-Doo, Great Grape Ape Show, which I have vague memories of what that was even about. Mm-hmm. With Charlotte's Web here, they're obviously working with tonier material, having the E.B. White book. They did add a number of songs, but pretty much stuck with the basic story. A barn spider named Charlotte befriends a piglet named Wilbur, who's being raised for slaughter. She eventually saves him by spinning these messages about him in her web, which make Wilbur a sensation in the county.
Your success today was, to a small degree, my success. You will live now secure and safe.
Why did you do this for me, Charlotte?
As I said, Charlotte is voiced by Debbie Reynolds. Henry Gibson is the voice of Wilbur. And what's interesting is Charlotte becomes a teacher. She's a caretaker, a provider. She's really mother to Wilbur long before she literally becomes one herself. And that happens in the heartbreaking finale. I'm going to give a spoiler here if you haven't read the book. But Charlotte dies after laying her eggs. Very, very, I don't know if it came to mind to you, Adam, while you were watching My Octopus Teacher, but it was like very similar climaxes going on. Now, the tragedy of the story is that Charlotte isn't going to be around to be a mother for her own children, but three baby spiders, they do stay in the barn where Wilbur can look after them. I actually like the 2006 live-action version of Charlotte's Web better than this one. It has Julia Roberts as the voice of Charlotte, but this is still a really potent piece of children's storytelling, and it does have this great, if unconventional, mom. So thanks, Dustin. Thanks, Aaron, for thinking of this one.
Yeah, almost could call you out on a technicality, but I think it's such a good pick, and indeed, she does become truly a mother, not just sort of a surrogate mother at the end of the film. I probably would have made that explicit connection to My Octopus Teacher if the last time I consumed Charlotte's Web in any fashion wasn't 1983. I'm pretty sure it was 83.
Been a little while, huh?
It's been a bit. My number four is also a Charlotte, though a very different piece of work here, Josh. I'm going with Charlotte Andergast from Autumn Sonata. Double Bergman, Ingrid and Ingmar, first time working together, only time working together. In fact, the final film appearance for the great actress Ingrid Bergman, Oscar nominated for this turn as Charlotte Andergast. She is an acclaimed concert pianist, and she goes to visit her daughter, played by Liv Ullmann. Of course, it's a Bergman film. Liv Ullmann is Eva, and she lives in kind of the sticks, and they haven't seen each other for, I think it's 7 years. There's clearly a rift between them, going back to Eva's days as a child and feeling that her mother wasn't really around and maybe was too involved in her career to really care. And so, it being a Bergman film, you're also going to get a fair amount of angst and resentment all bubbling to the surface. This movie and this dynamic isn't really the same as Harold and Maude in terms of the question of whether you most relate to or sympathize with one character over the other, because the child in this case is so much older. But you do still find yourself over the course of the movie shifting from this feeling that, okay, Charlotte probably really was a terrible mother. You see how icy she is. You see that she could certainly be a little too exacting and distant and detached. And so surely, for Eva to be this aggrieved, it has to be rooted in reality. But as I said, it does shift a little bit, and you start to consider, at what point is Eva maybe pushing it too far? At what point is this perhaps a crutch, this resentment? She can be both maybe an innocent victim in some ways and someone who is guilty of relying on that resentment or almost requiring it of her mother. And there's a key scene in this movie where they each end up playing a prelude by Chopin. Again, former concert pianist, so Charlotte, very skilled technically, knows everything about this piece and how to approach it, and she wants to hear her daughter play. Eva protests, says, no, I'm not really that good. I don't really even know it. The mom insists. And Sam here, our producer, can maybe sneak some of the music underneath, but you don't have to be an expert on Chopin or classical music at all to hear that the playing's a little bit stilted and it's a little bit brutish. And Sven Nykvist is the DP here. The camera spends a good deal of time focusing on Bergman's face as she listens, but also cutting back to her daughter playing. And if you watch, it's not really sort of shot reverse shot in the technical sense, in that Bergman isn't looking at her daughter every time, or even I think any time that the camera does cut to her daughter, but it is very clearly her point of view. And so it is linking them together in this experience of mother watching as daughter is playing. And Bergman, I think, is just brilliant here. Most of the acting done with her eyes. I think it would actually be a pretty great exercise for a film class, for an acting class, or even a movie criticism class, where you asked a group of people to watch this scene. It's about 2 minutes, this particular sequence of the playing. And you had to chart Charlotte's emotional journey over those 2 minutes. I'm not going to break it down beat by beat here, except to say that I see immediately her disappointment, a disappointment that you know you shouldn't feel, maybe, towards one of your own children, but you can't avoid. It's visceral. It's instinctual. It's as if she sees something or hears something so vulgar in her playing that she can't help but react to it, almost offended by hearing Chopin sound that way. And then at some point over the course of this journey, it comes around to appreciation and maybe even something more than that, pride, a sort of reverence that her daughter perseveres, that she persists despite the futility. And it occurs to me that maybe that line, persisting despite the futility, pretty well sums up any Ingmar Bergman film. And at the end, she says, and seems genuine when she says it, "Eva, my dearest, I was just so moved." And when Eva asks, did she like it? She just has the best line. She says, "I liked you." Now, of course, that's not met with joy by her daughter. There's too much pain between them. So hearing, "I didn't like the music so much, but I liked you," turns into, well, then what was wrong with it? What was wrong with my playing? She knew she wasn't going to impress her. She gave all the disclaimers about how bad her playing was going to be, and I think she truly did believe that. Yet, of course, she can't help but be disappointed herself or be a little angry that she didn't actually impress her mom with her playing. And therein lies the joy of having parents and being a parent.
But she's being honest with her, right? Deathly honest, maybe. But so is Charlotte. Does that make Charlotte the half when you were saying the half mom you might want? Or were you thinking?
I'm actually leaving her out.
Oh, you're leaving her out? Okay.
No, she's not even in the 1.5, just because you see how scarred Eva is as you watch Autumn Sonata. And just imagine that maybe that wouldn't have been the best environment for you either.
Okay, got it. All right, my number three is Rebecca, played by Cicely Tyson in Sounder. This was another one that came up a bunch on social media. And given Tyson's passing in January and also this movie's pedigree as an Oscar nominee, I had been really curious about it. So use this list as a nudge to watch it. From what I saw in the comments, it would, you know, possibly work as one of those admirable moms. And yeah, it did turn out that way. Here's Dylan Dom, one of the listeners, to mention it on Facebook. "I saw this on TCM a couple of months ago during a Cicely Tyson marathon and was surprised by how great it was. Tyson's Rebecca was a strong and determined mother left to take care of the farm after her husband was sent to prison. An underrated performance from an underrated movie."
"But I gotta see you, Mr. Sheriff. You only gotta see Nathan."
"Well, I'd like to help you. That wouldn't do anything but get us both in trouble."
"They gonna give him a trial?"
"Probably sometime next week. I tell you what I'll do. I'll, as soon as I find out what day, I'll just drive on out to your place and let you know."
"You got you a low-life job, Mr. Sheriff."
So this is set in 1933 Louisiana, and Tyson's Rebecca is husband to Paul Winfield's Nathan. They're sharecroppers. They have 3 kids and a dog. The dog is named Sounder, where the movie gets its title. And yeah, their tenuous life, it just becomes even more threatened after Nathan is sent to prison for stealing food that his family desperately needs. Tyson is first billed, and she is the best thing about the movie, for sure. It's very earnest. It's often obvious as children's movies sometimes can be. The director here is Hollywood mainstay Martin Ritt. But one of its strengths is the time it takes to sketch out this humble life of this family in a way that isn't condescending or exploitative. And I think it avoids doing those things by following the lead of Cicely Tyson's performance. She really captures the beauty of their difficult life together in her laughter, her hugs, her little touches. There's a great aside where she fans with her hand a troubadour neighbor who's, after he's done singing, kind of to cool him off from his performance. She also gives a late night hug to Nathan that reminded me of the moment I've mentioned in Minari between Stephen Yeun and Yuri Han, where she's bathing him after a long day's work on their farm. And then there's this scene after Nathan's arrest where Rebecca tries to visit him at the jail and is turned away. Just, she's not going to be allowed to even see him. Very reminiscent of the real life predicament that we saw Fox Rich navigate in the recent Oscar-nominated documentary Time. Tyson herself was nominated for Best Actress. She lost to Liza Minnelli for Cabaret. The movie was nominated for Best Picture. Winfield also nominated, and so was Lon Elder III for his screenplay adaptation of the William H. Armstrong children's book. None of them won. Even so, glad I saw Sounder, and yeah, especially for Tyson's Rebecca.
Sounder was one of the blind spots that popped up pretty quickly into doing my research, and I really wanted to fit it in before forming this list. So I'm jealous. I'm glad you got to see it, and I'm happy it made your list. I will have to add it to my ever-growing watch list. My number three 1970s movie mom is Mabel Longhetti from John Cassavetes' A Woman Under the Influence. And through my first couple picks here, I hope I am successfully imparting that it would be too limiting, it would be inaccurate to suggest that either Mrs. Chasen or Charlotte from Autumn Sonata are bad parents, that they could be written off that quickly, but neither would be put on a pedestal as an ideal mother. They wouldn't make your list, Josh. They would not be eligible. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
It gets even more complicated with this pick of Mabel, where you have a mother who isn't just human and who isn't just flawed, but is legitimately suffering from mental illness. And in addition to that, has been burdened by the weight of societal expectations and the expectations of her husband. When we talked about this movie as part of our Cassavetes marathon a while back, I read an accurate but I think misguided plot synopsis I found of this movie that said John Cassavetes' devastating drama details the emotional breakdown of a suburban housewife and her family's struggle to save her from herself. And I think that perspective is, as I said, it's misguided. It should be completely reversed. In reality, it's a movie about this suburban housewife who has an emotional breakdown and her family's struggle to do anything to actually save her. They're completely unequipped to do it. And in fact, make matters only worse, I think. This is one of those moms for me, Josh, that would get at least a half.
Okay.
And I think it's because I was rewatching some scenes today, and one of the standout ones for me was that sequence where she is so excited, euphoric, a little bit manic, certainly, to meet her son as he's getting off the bus from school. And you see how genuinely thrilled she is, and then the way they run home together, and she then engages with all three of her kids there on the porch.
Oh, I hope you kids never grow up, never. Oh, you know, I never did anything in my whole life that was anything except I made you guys. I made you and you and you. Oh, my head, what a headache.
And that line, the only good thing I ever did was making you. She believes that. That feels to me completely genuine. And she is such a sympathetic character because she's trying so hard to be the mom that she knows she's supposed to be, that her kids need her to be, the wife she's supposed to be. And unlike the other moms I've mentioned, she isn't one who is trying to impose her will onto her children. You get the sense with Mabel that she does want to nurture them, that she wants to let them be themselves, and that she wants to let them have fun. She wants to let them express themselves, which is one of the key words for me when it comes to considering this film, because you look at the way Peter Falk's character as her husband tries to deal with her, and it's all about suppressing that expression. It's basically, you know what a suburban housewife means? You're an automaton. You know, you wake up, you get the kids dressed, you get them off to school, you make them food, you make me food when I come home, you keep the house clean, and that's kind of it. And I'm not suggesting, nor do I think that Cassavetes is suggesting that treatment alone or those expectations are responsible for her breakdown, but I do think the movie is ultimately trying to get at something larger and something more complicated, which is, how do you do those things? How do you still try to be an individual, be a person while subjugating yourself in that way and not feeling like you can actually express yourself. And really, at some point, not even really having a sense of who you are. That's one of the key sort of theatrical elements of the movie is the sense that Mabel is always performing. She's always trying to act the way her husband Nick wants her to act. And of course, in trying to do that, she's always getting it wrong. So I'm not sure that she quite qualifies as wholly admirable or desirable as a mother, but she certainly has some admirable traits. And I do think she's ultimately a very sympathetic mother.
Well, I am glad you referenced that bus sequence, waiting for her son to get off the bus, because then we don't have to relitigate our differences over the portrayal of Mabel
right.
in this movie. Your listeners can go back to our review of the film and that Cassavetes marathon for that. But yeah, the bus sequence for me is the one that did ring the most true, or at least brought us the closest to who Mabel is underneath her more theatrical episodes, let's say. You know, it really rooted, it made me really understand the pressures she felt as a mother, the genuine desire that was also there beyond those pressures, that which speaks to how you're, you know, giving her the credit for having the potential, and in some instances we see it, to be a good mother, that she really does want to be that and that she can be that in some ways. So I think that's a great scene in A Woman Under the Influence. Okay, time for a dad break. Up next, I'll have thoughts on Wrath of Dad, I mean, Wrath of Man, with Jason Statham. Then we'll spend a few minutes on Chantal Ackerman's News from Home before revealing our top two 70s movie moms. Stay with us. Listening to Film Spotting. Call it what you want, TV, limited series, 10-part movie. We don't care, Josh. We are watching the new Barry Jenkins, and we're going to talk about it on the show, The Underground Railroad. It's a new era, Adam. All rules are off. We watch what we want to watch.
That's it. That's from the trailer for his adaptation of The Underground Railroad, the 2016 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Colson Whitehead. Now, Josh, were you a good intellectual back in 2016 and read this? Are you cramming in your homework this weekend, or you going in without any sense of the source material?
Any sense of the source material, so much so that when I started reading a little bit more about what's actually happening in this series, it took me by surprise. I'm not going to say it here. Just don't want to spoil anything, even though I don't think it's a spoiler, but the very premise surprised me and got me even more excited for this.
Okay, well, now I'm really excited because I haven't read that premise and I have no clue what I'm in for. That's the way I like it. We will spend some time on next week's episode talking about at least the first couple of episodes. I'm not sure we're going to get to all 10. I'm not sure all 10 are even available to us, but we are looking forward to that. We will also wrap up our 40s noir marathon with 1949's White Heat, directed by Raoul Walsh and starring James Cagney. This was a big one, along with Lady from Shanghai, for me in terms of really wanting to do this marathon. Huge, huge blind spot for me when it comes to noir.
We're also going to do our end of marathon awards. And as usual, we need some suggestions. What should we call these awards? There has been already thrown out there, I think by Sam, that it should be something probably inspired by Anne Savage's Vera in Detour. Maybe a bit of her dialogue. Maybe just the Savages. We just go with the Savages.
The Savages. Actually, I mean, it's pretty fitting, right?
Good backup. We'll see what listeners come up with.
Okay. You recall my favorite Anne Savage line, shut up, you're making noises like a husband. Could be the husbands, too. Also, next week, we'll share the results of the current Film Spotting poll, which is inspired by Cagney's turn as White Heat crime boss Arthur Cody Jarrett. We're asking, what's your favorite movie crime boss performance this century? Had to narrow it down. The movies love crime bosses, Josh. Your options, Daniel Day-Lewis, Bill the Butcher in Gangs of New York. Denzel Washington is Frank Lucas, an American gangster. Pesci as Russell Bufalino in The Irishman, more Scorsese, Jack Nicholson as Frank Costello in The Departed, Jackie Weaver as Janine Smurf Cody in Animal Kingdom, or you could go Ralph Fiennes as Harry Waters in Bruges, the Martin McDonagh film. And if those don't work for you, you could go other and write in your candidate.
Now, did we talk about our preferences last time? I can't even remember, Adam.
I can't remember either. I feel like we didn't. Do you have a clear winner here? Because I don't.
I don't either, which makes me think we might have, and I was just waffling then and haven't decided. But I'm leaning towards, I'm going to, two ends of the spectrum here.
Yes, I know where you're going.
Nicholson's Costello.
Okay,
right?
I thought you were going Day-Lewis and Pesci.
Oh, well.
Because Bill the Butcher is pretty big.
Yeah, it's, you know what? You're right. That's the way I'm thinking. But I like how that Costello and Bufalino, Pesci's Bufalino, are mm-hmm. kind of in the same universes. You know, Gangs of New York mm-hmm. is in its own crazy, historically based universe that Daniel Day-Lewis is just presiding over like a madman. But you have in contemporary gangsterdom these two figures and Nicholson, who's fantastic, just chewing up the movie. And Pesci, who's maybe even better, doing it all on a low register.
Yep.
And so, I don't know. It's going to be one of those two for me.
Yeah. I think, for me, it's going to be. Now, I will note that The Departed is by far my favorite film of the bunch. But I think it's the other Scorsese, Gangs in New York, and it is Bill the Butcher, only because if there had to be just one of those performances that I would put on right now, just for the performance, it would be to watch Daniel Day-Lewis again as Bill the Butcher.
You're not picturing the three of them in like a muddy square with knives going at it, and you think Bill would win. That's not why you're going with him.
No, though he would, of
course.
He would. He'd take on all other five or six candidates here and dominate. Three Oscar nominees in there, no winners. And maybe no surprise, actually, that Daniel Day-Lewis is currently leading the pack. You can vote in that poll and leave a comment at filmspotting.net.
Do you have any idea how dangerous this job can be?
Some idea, yeah.
We ain't the predators. We're the prey.
You ready?
Ready.
I can't wait for this, Josh. What was my snarky comment when you said in Slack you were going to see this movie? Something like, how desperate do you have to be for a theater-going experience that you are reviewing Wrath of Man? And I want to be clear.
I mean,
you know, I enjoy my Jason Statham, too.
Some of us are snobs, I think, is maybe the clear answer. And some of us aren't, but go ahead. Also, reason number two. It's a movie. It's a movie, Adam.
It's a movie. I mean, that's really what it is. But this movie opens wide this weekend. It's directed by Guy Ritchie, stars Jason Statham as H, a mysterious character. He's always mysterious, who works for a cash truck company that moves hundreds of millions of dollars around L.A. Yes, he also always seems to be in transit.
Yes.
I do, as I was saying, love some Jason Statham. And I was almost intrigued enough by this trailer to want to go out and see it myself, because there's just something cool about Jason Statham and watching him do anything. And he is in all those driver movies, and that's what I'm going to call them, because I have no idea what they're actually.
Transporter, Adam.
Now, see, you ruined it.
The Transporter series, I believe, is what you're referring to.
I just wanted to keep imagining what they were called, and I'm going to call him The Driver. I'm just going to call him The Driver or Driver movies instead. I like that better. Of course, I do know him from what work he's done in the Fast and Furious movies, where he is also doing a fair amount of driving and punching and shooting. You did watch this because you not only could see it in the theater, you could bike to the critic screening from your house. The new Josh Larson living it up in Chicago like a young man again. It must be so invigorating. How was it? Was this your first proper critic screening in a year or more?
Oh, more. Yeah.
And was it worth it?
It was the first one since the before times. Absolutely.
The before
and
times.
Yes,
yeah.
That was part of the reason. Sadly, I cannot give a review of the bike ride because it ended up raining. And so that part did not pan out.
Oh, no.
And you know what? I have to say Wrath of Man. Godzilla versus Kong, which I did see in a theater, about a month ago. First movie in a theater since last summer, got the theatrical bump a little bit. I'm going to confess. I think there are good things about that movie, but it certainly got a bump from the experience. Didn't really help Wrath of Man, I'm afraid.
No?
No, I'm sorry to report, and it's not Jason Statham's fault. very good in the Transporter movies. You know, I could go on and on about Hobbs and Shaw, Adam. I will not do that here.
Oh,
but
please don't.
He's so good in Hobbs and Shaw. This one, I mean, the major problem is there's not enough Jason Statham. It really starts out quite fun. These armored cars. It's like a heist flick all about armored cars and robbery attempts. And you have this question early on. There's a robbery attempt that he thwarts. H thwarts pretty much on his own, even though he's a little bit older and he barely like passed the qualification tests to get in, to get this job. So everyone's looking at him a little side eye. But then when it comes down to it, he handles the robbers expertly. So you're wondering, right? What is with this guy? What's his secret, Adam? What's his history? Well, unfortunately, Guy Ritchie kind of takes Statham, puts him on a shelf at the midpoint of this movie, and explores that history by discombobulating the timeline unnecessarily, sends us into this criminal underworld that is, you know, kind of generically Guy Ritchie, but also gets really incredibly nasty, like unnecessarily putrid corners of humanity we have to go explore for some reason that takes you out of the movie. By the time he gets back to Statham, like I just felt like the life had been sucked out of me. And so even though there's this massive heist climax that Statham is a part of, you kind of don't really care. So, you know, Statham, I have a better track record with than Ritchie. He wasn't the draw here. The guy's insanely talented, though. The movie opens with another heist of an armored car, but it's told from a fixed camera point in the back of the vehicle that does pan a little bit, but it's this extended, essentially single take heist that's really well done. It kind of withholds information from you to up the intensity and the suspense, and it plays crucially in the plot later. So there's a great opening to this film, way downhill from there. Statham's good, but he doesn't get any chance to really show the comic chops he has as well. So you'll forget this movie ever existed, Adam. I'm going to try to forget that I saw it.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure, based on that not so glowing recommendation, that Wrath of Man is going to be the first movie I take my fully vaccinated self to. I think it's got to be something maybe a little better.
I took
than
the
Wrath
hit
Man.
For you. I took the hit
yeah,
for
I
you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Wrath of Man is currently playing in wide release. You also, Josh, really were just a busy boy. You caught up with director Roy Anderson's cash truck thriller. It's called About Endlessness. Except the Swedish auteur's version has, I'm sorry, I'm being told, no cash trucks, no Jason Statham. I'm guessing there's probably not even any gunshots or maybe even any punches. Have I been misled? And let me say, this is what everyone should love about Film Spotting, that we will go that quickly from Jason Statham to Swedish auteur Roy Anderson. That's Anderson with two S's.
Let's dial up the snobbery. All right, let's get back on track here, Adam, right? Because Anderson was maybe the discovery of our Nordic cinema marathon a couple of years back. When we did we just do Songs from the Second Floor, or did we also check out
You the Living?
Yeah, both. I mean, Songs from the Second Floor, to me, still remains his masterpiece. He also made A Pigeon Sat on a Branch, Reflecting on Existence. Those three and this one, About Endlessness.
Also starring Jason Statham. Yeah.
No Jason Statham. I'm going to have to go back, though, and see, was there an armored car? Because these are like series of vignettes, right? There's no plot. Uh-huh. We're just dropped in these little scenes, and they kind of are brought together. And there is, it may share with Wrath of Man, a little bit of nihilism. You could say very different brand of nihilism, but I would say what distinguishes About Endlessness from the others, maybe, it's pretty much of a piece, but I did find it to be maybe the least hopeful one. And these movies are all balancing their tragicomedies, right? The kind of like the fruitlessness of life, but yet the little moments of humor that are in it and how those are sometimes connected. And this one gets pretty bleak. There's no tuba. I think we talked about the tuba as kind of this musical levity in some of his other films. Here, the movie opens with this amazing bravura image, this couple who's floating in embrace over a sky that's dominated by these gray, ominous clouds. And we hear in the background this solemn choral piece. And that's really representative of what you get in this movie, are the amazing, almost diorama-like visuals, but a heavier sadness. It's almost like a defeated work a little bit more than some of the others. Another vignette is of a defeated army walking, being marched through the snow towards a prisoner of war camp. There are some moments of levity, a great dance number, some young women passing by an outdoor cafe, and they just begin dancing to this song playing there. That kind of lightens it a little bit. But to give you an idea, one of the few characters who shows up in multiple vignettes, sometimes he'll do that, right? We'll follow someone who pops up in more than one, is a priest who's lost his faith. And he just kind of wanders around crying, what should I do now that I've lost my faith? And in true Anderson fashion, the other characters in the scenes often ignore him or kind of push him out of a door so they don't have to deal with him. So yeah, this won't shock you or surprise you if you've seen another Anderson film. If you haven't seen one, go ahead and start here, because you will get a sense of what he's doing completely and be taken away by how carefully crafted these scenes are, often with fixed cameras. I think all with fixed cameras. And it's just an experience unlike any other you'll have at the movies. I can't think of another filmmaker even to really compare him to. I mean, maybe Jacques Tati in a way, but very different sensibilities. And so, yeah, I highly, highly recommend About Endlessness, especially if Anderson is new to you.
I want to see it, but what I want to see even more, Roy Anderson's Wrath of Man, Guy Ritchie's About Endlessness.
Well, you know, both titles could work either way, I think.
Maybe. Maybe so. About Endlessness is currently playing in limited release, including here in Chicago, and that's because life is fleeting and hopeless.
What do you do?
I'm a professor. I teach communication at NYU.
That woman was a student of yours?
Sheila? Yeah, she was. Is. Was.
No saying my mother told me. You want to hear it?
Sure.
Don't shit where you eat.
Okay. The late Olympia Dukakis there, just bringing it with John Mahoney in a scene from 1987's Moonstruck, a scene in a clip that was shared a lot this past week on social media with Dukakis passing away at the age of 89. She was a 54-year-old theater veteran when she appeared in Moonstruck in 87. She won a supporting actress Oscar for her performance. Josh, I just caught up with Moonstruck in 2016, according to my Letterboxd log. I must have been finally seeing it because I was doing some kind of top five list. Maybe it was Nicolas Cage related. I don't know, but I do know I watched it and loved it and couldn't believe I'd gone that long, really not thinking it was important to see it. I knew kind of its reputation. It didn't seem like one of those snobby cinephile movies, Josh, that was an egregious blind spot. I was wrong. If you haven't seen it, and if you haven't seen how good Olympia Dukakis is in it, then you definitely need to remedy that.
Well, in this scene, she has this sort of, it's an unruffled authority that she, you know, she just brings not only the dialogue, but even if you watch it, the physicality of just where she's sitting, how she sits at that table in that restaurant. And, you know, she is in charge of that room. And, you know, you can see it also in the way that she manages Mahoney. We should also mention, though, our friend Michael Phillips at the Chicago Tribune, another write-up on her career and her movies. He does such a great job of these in memoriam pieces and has another good one that we can link to in the show notes.
We will do that over at filmspotting.net. This week on our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, it's part two of their One Wedding and a Funeral pairing. I'm told, Josh, it's Shiva, baby, which is available
yes.
via VOD. And Jonathan Demme's Rachel Getting Married. Tasha is off. Critic Jordan Hoffman is filling in. I wonder if he will truly fill Tasha's shoes and go to war with Scott Tobias. I'd tune in to hear that. The Next Picture Show is hosted by Tasha, Scott, Keith Phipps, and Genevieve Kosky. New episodes post every Tuesday wherever you get your podcast. More info is available at nextpictureshow.net. One way that you can support our show is to join the Film Spotting family over on Patreon. $5 a month gets you early show downloads, gets you ad-free episodes via a dedicated RSS feed. You also get monthly bonus episodes. We did talk about Hal Ashby's Shampoo here recently, starring Warren Beatty, Julie Christie, and Goldie Hawn. And this month, we haven't even put this out there to family members yet, but our thought is that we're going to give them a choice between a Robert Altman trifecta. Robert Altman, one of those directors who is all over the Film Spotting Madness shortlist, made 13 films between 1970 and 1979. And we've seen the big ones, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Nashville, The Long Goodbye. MASH is one, Josh, his big breakthrough that I have seen, but you haven't. And then, yeah, we've got like 9 more titles, and the other two we're eyeing in addition to MASH are 2 other shared blind spots: California Split with Elliot Gould and George Segal, and Three Women with Shelley Duvall and Sissy Spacek. So Altman, trifecta work for you?
Oh yeah, great idea. And from what I remember, I think it was a trivia spotting event where there was a lot of praise for Altman's Three Women,
yes,
which, you know, I was aware of, but is not usually talked about in the realm of some of those other titles. So yeah, glad to see that is in the mix, and we'll see what family members vote for.
We will indeed. We also allow our family members to have exclusive access to our monthly trivia spotting events. Our 10th one is coming up. We're calling it Trivia Spotting 10 to Yuma. It is Saturday, May 15th, and it is sold out for the player ticket. But if you're a family member who hasn't participated in one of these before, or maybe you're a little bit shy, have some social anxiety, and you don't want to participate on a team, you can still partake in most of the trivia spotting fun at a reduced cost. Those spectator tickets, there's still a few, Josh, just a handful available, and we look forward to seeing everybody back there. Have a couple new captains this week, as we always do as well. We remind you, too, that you can pay for an annual membership, and that gives you a 10% discount. You get over 1 month of your membership for free. Patreon.com/filmspotting.
It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a film spotting t-shirt. A couple of weeks ago, Adam and I, but mostly Michael Phillips, massacred this scene.
This here's a big country.
Yeah, but it ain't big enough for cattlemen and homesteaders, and it never will be. Now clear out of here.
All right, Dean. We're going. We're going back to build our fences.
If you do, you better build coffins along with them.
Of course, that was Walter Brennan as Judge Roy Bean in 1940's The Westerner, which was written by Joe Swerling and Nevin Bush, directed by, he comes up often, we're going to do a marathon on him one day, William Wyler.
Along with that massacre, Michael and Josh and I shared our Oscar picks. It was our Oscars special. So why that scene from The Westerner? Well, we got this from Jason Kinchin. He's in Billerica. Actually, Josh, Massachusetts. I'm very surprised to hear that this week's Massacre Theater is so sparsely entered. I suppose many have just not seen The Westerner with Gary Cooper and, more notably, Walter Brennan. Film spotting historians will no doubt remember Michael Phillips' past affinity for the lauded character actor in past episodes. Also, Josh didn't even bother to change the name Bean. A dead giveaway as Brennan played the notorious Texas judge Roy Bean, the law west of the Pecos, in that film. It does seem like Westerns are still a blind spot of film spotting nation. Pity, Jason says.
We also heard from Andrew Howell in Lake Oswego, Oregon. My hunt started because Josh said it was tied to the Oscars. So I looked for a movie with Michael Phillips' long-lost father, Walter Brennan, and movies that he won Oscars for. And this one was the best fit. But I'll admit, I haven't seen The Westerner. This might be the most detective work I've done for a Massacre Theater, still one of my favorite segments of the show. I demand more Sam voiceovers. His participation are among the best.
I don't disagree with you there, Andrew. We also got this request from Jared R. in Springfield, Missouri. Simply, Josh, more Michael Phillips. Twice a year isn't enough.
Agreed.
Yeah, fully agreed. And I think maybe we didn't have Michael on quite as much because we used to always meet at the studio and we'd record together face to face, and dealing with the mics and the computers and the recording sessions online just seemed a bit of a hassle. But I think by now we've got it down, and there's no reason why Michael shouldn't be making some more regular appearances here on the show. Sparsely entered, as Jason said, because we had joked about how maybe after the first week there were about 4 entries. I looked again today, Josh. Maybe Westerns like this one are still a blind spot for most of Film Spotting Nation, but we got all the way up to 21 entries.
Oh my goodness.
Not exactly brimming, but we got up to 21.
Enough for a winner.
Yeah, I'm guessing a lot of people did some detective work like Andrew. They came up with The Westerner. Reach in and pick out this week's winner.
Our winner is Bruce Cantwell from Portland.
Congratulations, Bruce. That's Portland, Oregon. And he's been listening since at least 2009. So going back over a decade, I was sure he'd won Massacre Theater before, but I don't think that's true. Check the records. Wasn't seeing it. Congratulations, Bruce. Been a long time. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
We move on to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, a more recent vintage, this film, compared to the Westerner.
Yes.
Probably more recognizable, more widely seen by our audience, though we are going to wreak havoc with the script a little bit. It's not exactly radio friendly, not exactly family friendly. And I'm blanking on that word. We're going to have to look it up. Remember the listener who wrote in the last time we changed a bunch of swear words and said there was actually a term for it? When you,
oh, yeah,
when you
you're right.
Insert different words and phrases to take the place of swear words. I don't recall it right now. Someone out there listening, maybe a few people, are shouting it and looking crazy to everyone around them, Josh. But that's what we're going to do with this scene. And I'm going to take on a role. Here's another hint. This isn't why we're doing this scene. I think that reason will become pretty clear pretty quickly. But this is another performance that was Oscar winning, was it not?
Oh, now we're doing trivia spotting again. I know it was nominated. Yeah. Let me see.
One nominated or snubbed this scene. Josh.
The way this scene goes, I'm going to say she had to have won.
I think she won.
It just seems like, you know, this is a capital O Oscar performance. Yeah. Yes, she did win. So you're stepping up to the plate here. Are you ready for this?
I'm really trying to step up here. You're going to start it off, so I'll give you the action. Are you ready?
Yes.
And action.
Did you, I mean, when I was a kid, did you ever love me or anything?
You think Sonya Henie's mother loved her? Poor fussin' you. I didn't stay home making apple brown Betty's, no. I made you a clock stuffer, knowing you'd hate me for it. That's the sacrifice a mother makes. I wish I'd had a mother like me instead of nice. Nice gets you fuss. I didn't like my mother either, so what? I fussin' gave you a gift.
You cursed me. You're a monster.
Spilled milk, baby. And scene. I think I played it a little huskier than she does.
Yeah, a little huskier. You might have turned into someone else there for the last line. Also, I have a question. Nice gets you what? What does it get you?
Nice gets you, it gets you fuss.
Okay.
We've just entered the fantastic Mr. Fox world. That's cuss, right?
Yeah, that would be cuss. We did a little cussing.
Okay, well, close enough. Again, a family show. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. The deadline is Monday, May 17th. The best part of my performance, nobody saw but you, Josh. It was the elongated eye roll after your first line. That's where I was really bringing it.
Oh, yeah. I was like, that brought me into the moment. I thought I was doing Massacre Theater. And then when I saw that, I was like being reprimanded by a mother.
Yep.
It was amazing. Yep. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of fussin' weeks.
Ma très chère petite fille, j'ai bien reçu ta lettre et j'espère que tu continueras à nous faire souvent. De toute façon, j'espère que tu nous reviendras vite. J'espère que tu continues à bien te porter, tu travailles déjà. Je vois que New York te plaît, tu es contente, alors nous sommes contents aussi, malgré qu'on voudrait te revoir le plus vite. Dis-nous qu'en penses-tu revenir.
Dearest child, I received your letter and hope you'll write often. In any case, I hope you'll be home soon. So begins the narration in Chantal Ackerman's News from Home from 1976. It's the next film in our 7 from 76 Best Year Ever series. We started this series with four of the year's biggest titles, and they were all Best Picture nominees: Rocky, All the President's Men, Network, and Taxi Driver. Now for these last three slots, we're going to turn to some blind spots. Ackerman's News from Home was the follow-up to her 1975 masterpiece, Jean Dielman, part of our overlooked auteurs marathon last year, definitely one of the highlights from that marathon. We praise Jean Dielman for its formal audaciousness, including the prolonged static shots that she used. News from Home, it retains that formal conceit, but largely strips away any sense of narrative. The movie consists of long, mostly still shots of New York City taken during the summer of 1976 in locations where Ackerman spent time when she was living in the city earlier in the decade. The narration is taken from letters read by Ackerman herself that her mother sent her while she was living abroad. Now, Adam, as we've mentioned several times over the past year, Ackerman's Jean Dielman, a revelation for us. Here's her follow-up. I guess you could call it even more avant-garde as a project. So I'm curious how it worked for you.
All I care about, Josh, you said there's no narrative, but the stakes are so high. I really, really want to know if she got those summer clothes.
Yeah. There's a lot of, I want to talk about the drama in this film. That's one of the most dramatic elements, right?
Poor mom writing week after week, letter after letter, just wants to know if her baby girl got the box of summer clothes. Unrequited, never seems to get an answer. The cruelty of children. News from Home definitely worked for me. Not maybe on the level of John Dielman. And actually, I was kind of hoping it was my turn to do a setup this week, because the thing I was going to throw back at you, and of course, this saved me from having to actually try to articulate it and make it eloquent. But one of the things we loved about John Dielman is that all that restraint and those static shots and the kind of hypnotic trance that her routine puts you under, it does eventually pay off in that there is kind of an epiphany. There is a change. There's a revelation. And that comes, if not fairly early, like it was for me when she walks out of the bedroom after that second encounter with the John and her hair's disheveled and you know something's up, then it's definitely by the time she burns the potatoes and it seems like the whole world is crumbling around her. This is a film that, for the most part, stays in the same kind of static realm. And I was wondering, Josh, if it ever gave you any moment of revelation where things really changed and you looked at everything in a different way, or was that maybe not what you needed from this endeavor?
Oh, I think there are a lot of moments of revelation in here, but they're not necessarily, as we've suggested, narrative ones or ones that answer this relationship between mother and daughter, maybe, but they're almost more like formal revelations. I mean, right. I just really appreciated this as a variation on slow cinema, if it's not slow cinema itself. And I am thrilled that we made room for it in this series, because you could have, you know, we could have said, anyone could say, I've seen John Dielman. I checked off that Ackerman box. You know, that's the big one. I have a sense of what she's all about and kind of move on. And this is, I got to say, this for me was right up there in terms of a revealing experience and also just another audacious and brilliant reinvention of what a movie can be. In, as we've already discussed, different ways than John Dielman is. But here is someone, you know, if that was broadly defined as a domestic, intimate domestic drama or character study, but unlike one you've ever seen, here we have a movie that's essentially the story of leaving your family to live on your own. It's the story of a mother-daughter relationship, but it's told in a way, again, you've never seen in terms of the form it actually takes, this juxtaposing these images of street scenes in New York City with reading this text. And as far as like the revelations, here's one I'll give you an example of, and it relates to your question or your comment about the summer clothes, right? Mm-hmm. We have the drama of the letters going on. How are they going to answer each other? What is the mother concerned about now? That's one drama. We have the drama of the people watching the camera when they notice that there's a camera. I think this especially happens on the subway, and we ask ourselves, what will they do? You know, how are they going to respond? But then there's the drama of the formalism, and this is where it was just so revealing to me that I can sit here. There's a shot where the camera is inside the subway looking at the subway door window, and the subway is moving. And we see when it's in the tunnel, when things are dark outside, we can see the faint reflection of a woman who's standing in the car, probably next to the camera, right? And then we go into the station. It gets brighter, and she disappears. And so you're sitting there in the station waiting for it to pick up again. And you start to wonder, did the woman get off? Is she still on the car? Again, very minor stakes to put it in those terms. But the train starts up. We're back in the dark and we see, oh, she's still there. And we sit on that train for another couple of stops. And this becomes its own mini drama playing out in this single take. What, you know, is this woman going to be there next time? When does she get off? Who is she? We start to wonder these sorts of things. It was very Leviathan-y for me, you know, the fishing trawler documentary that I love, where I talked about at least finding drama in just a fish flopping on the boat's deck that we're sitting with for a couple of minutes. And there are continual shots like that in News from Home that worked on me in this way, including the one that I think we can talk about may have an element of narrative revelation, which is the final shot. I'm curious what you made of the final shot, but also the other elements of the film.
Well, there is something that is profound, of course, about this whole experience and this idea that we've been wondering if Chantel, the character, is going to stay in New York City, if she is ever going to go home, if she's going to reunite with her mother. And I don't know what we're supposed to make of that final shot or not, but it is a very long take, multiple minutes from a boat deck pulling away from the city of New York. And it's ironic, too, because it's the only shot in the movie. And I think you could also make the case that most of the time you're looking at the seagulls anyway. There you go. Now it's back to Leviathan, Josh. See, now I know why you like this movie.
Yep.
You're paying more attention to the seagulls following the camera and floating in the air than you are maybe the city itself. But it's the only shot in the film, the irony of it, the maybe tragedy of it, if you will, where we see the grandeur of New York City, what we're used to seeing in a movie. And it's only in what she's seeing from a distance as she's finally getting away from the city. I was thinking while watching this film that it's not quite, you know, Taxi Driver in its depiction in terms of the grittiness or the griminess or the sleaziness of New York City. But compared to something like a few years later, like Woody Allen's Manhattan, of course, totally making it this fantasy land. It's a far cry from that, too. And you think of all these movies over the years that have made New York City, quote unquote, a character, to the point where, you know, David Wayne made a whole movie, They Came Together, that's just an extended riff on that idea of New York City as a character in a movie. And here, New York City really is the only character. Like, it's all you see is the city of New York, but you don't see it at all how you expect to see it. You don't see it definitely the way it is typically romanticized on film. And I think it's just a very sober reflection on being away from family, on trying to chart your own path, and like some of the other films in our 7 from 76 series, about loneliness. And I think that's where the formalism really comes into play here. And you see kind of the poetry of the way the cameras use, because it's not totally still. The camera does pan eventually. There's a couple of 360 camera shots. There's one sequence where she's clearly in a taxi cab or some other moving vehicle shooting the city as she goes. But for the most part, that camera is planted in the ground and it is watching the city, observing the city. And the more you saw those people, especially on the subway, starting to notice the camera and kind of looking at it, but still then going about their business, or coming up so close to the camera, almost intimate with it, but then doing what? Ultimately walking on by. You sort of see the camera as this stand-in for Ackerman herself, this lonely figure that is there in this city, but is being completely ignored, that is completely disconnected from the rest of the city. And even then, too, the dialogue that's taking place between the mother and daughter is completely one way. Mm-hmm. We never know what is happening in the letters that are going back to the mother. We never hear those. We pick up snippets from what the mother says in her letters, but otherwise it is a completely one-way conversation, which also, for me, matches so beautifully the dialogue, the conversation that is happening with the city of New York. Between Ackerman and the city of New York, it too is this one-way dialogue where it's her observing, it's her capturing what she's seeing, but not really getting anything back from it. Again, there's this kind of distance. And, you know, we were joking about stakes. The more you get into those letters, the comments from the mom, and you start to hear some of the recurring names and situations, you realize that these are characters in her stories, and they could be anybody and they could be nobody. They could be totally made up. It's as if you're hearing just these kind of sketches of life that are happening, and you don't really have, again, I'll use that word, connection. You have no actual connection. It's as if she just needs these people to populate her letters to give even them some sense of drama, you know, the same way Ackerman needs the city and the people walking among it to add some drama to her story.
Yeah, I want to get to the content of those letters, but as far as the depiction of New York City here, it is so unique to what we've seen in so many of the other movies, not only in this series, but just in general. And I think you're absolutely right to identify it as a portrait of loneliness. I mean, we do get a few crowded streets. We get a jammed subway car at another point where, you know, it's full of people, but mostly we get empty streets. I mean, the first few shots, there's not a person at all. And there are a few figures on the screen. And, you know, those are all choices. Ackerman could have gone, this is where I think, you know, we're just guessing as to why, what she's trying to communicate with these images. But clearly, she could have gone to, you know, the busiest center of New York if that's what she wanted to capture. And that's what we usually get in movies in New York City. But she's deliberately found these nighttime diners where there's only one figure, the shop with the guy making pizza all by himself, the other guy sitting outside of a, you know, a repair shop just by himself. This is very intentionally, I think, a portrait of loneliness, as you said. And man, it's accentuated by those letters, I think. You know, her mother constantly wanting to know. I think at one point she says, like, good to know you've found friends or something. But then in a later letter, she says something like, do you have friends? So it's almost like, was that a wishful gesture? That, like, was her mom picking up on a very vague reference to someone she met in an earlier letter? And she wants to put that person in the place of friend because she wants her to have a friend so bad. But those letters are incredibly poignant. I feel like I have a picture of that woman's entire life just from what she's shared, even though it's often repetitive. She's, you know, shares health concerns, who, as you said, who they're meeting, what they're doing, birthday parties. But that gives you the rhythm of her life. And you start to feel like even the seasons, you know, we go back to, I think she's the one who says, I've never liked the summers, something like that, or it's too hot. And then it's the winter. And we're starting to feel how this woman, who we never see even a photo of, lives her life. But also, how about the level of passive aggressiveness? And maybe we can say particularly motherly passive aggressiveness in those letters. So, we're not angry you left without a word. just leaves that. Or even something a little kinder and gentler. You know, I live for your letters. And, you know, it's
so
a,
in other words, write more, damn it.
Which is essentially what she says in the next sentence, usually, right? And, and so that just all adds to this picture of Ackerman's mother, who I know and I'm dying to see in Ackerman's last film, 2015's No Home Movie, essentially a conversation that she has with her mother. So this is just, you know, made me incredibly curious to see if the woman, and it doesn't necessarily have to do this, but I'm just curious if the woman I think I have in my head from these letters is the woman I would meet there.
Yeah, I tried to use watching this movie as a teaching experience with my daughter, Sophie. So I'm having the father-daughter viewing of this film and keeping in the back of my mind the whole time that she's a year and a half away from going to college. And I started just kind of doing my own little passive aggressive jabbing about how terrible kids are in terms of they just go out into the world and they just leave their parents behind, don't they? But of course, I'm joking. And she also knew I wasn't joking. And you do think about how tethered we are now, for better or for worse, and the way it would have been absolutely debilitating, as it seems almost to be for this mother, to be that far away from her daughter and the only connection. And yes, you could talk on the phone, though it's also very clear that that would be very costly, and it's not like they have a bunch of income to just throw around. The only way they can communicate with each other is these letters. And you think about that compared now, Josh, to Sophie could be in Paris or New York, and I can be here in Chicago, and we're texting each other constantly, and we're always connected, or we're FaceTiming, or we're doing whatever, we're Zooming with each other. And there is a paralyzing sort of realization of disconnect that you sympathize with, and you ache for this mom a little bit watching it. I did anyway, as a parent myself.
Well, this goes back to the generational thing we were talking about with Mrs. Chasen in Harold and Maude, you know, how the overbearing, the overconnected parent we can now be compared to what you could be in the 70s via technology. And your experience with Sophie, I mean, we just picked up our older daughter from college, from a couple of months in college in New York City, no less. So that's in my head. And thinking over the past couple of months, how many times we did text or we did FaceTime, and then realizing, you know, well, there's probably, we tried to be like, you know, both of us want to, of course, but we were like, we've got to give her space. And hopefully we weren't like being overbearing in that way. But I'm sure there are times where she's like, listen, I came here to be on my own. So give me that space. Give me some breathing room. So watching that, I'm completely in tension between the two voices. Well, the one voice you hear, the motherly voice, and then also the person you see through the camera lens, as you talked about.
Yeah, absolutely. News from Home is currently streaming on the Criterion Channel, and pretty hard to find elsewhere. More about the 7 from 76 Best Year Ever series is at filmspotting.net/7from76. Still to come, another documentary, Barbara Koppel's Harlan County, USA, and Car Wash, directed by Michael Schultz and featuring performances by Richard Pryor, George Carlin, and the Pointer Sisters. Yes, you have all of that to be excited about. And with that, we will get back to the top five list that was inspired by Chantel Aukerman's News from Home. Top five 70s movie moms. I know our producer Sam threw out somewhere in the newsletter or Twitter or both the question about memories you have of seeing movies with your mom. And I don't know, Josh, if you have any in particular as we transition back into the list. I remember, and I think I have mentioned this on the show before, going to see, and I don't know why it's only this movie. I remember going to see as a very young kid, 8 or 9 years old, White Knights, Gregory Hines and Mikhail Baryshnikov, because my mom, like a lot of moms, I think, was pretty enamored with Mikhail Baryshnikov as a man and as a ballet dancer. So going to see White Knights was actually a pretty big deal in my small little Iowa town with my mom. I also remember making the mistake as I became a budding cinephile. I mean, I was just into it, Josh. Pretty much saw like Reservoir Dogs, and then not too long after watched Blue Velvet and said, oh, I'm in. I want art house cinema. I'm going to be obsessed with this. I think I was so obsessed, I came home one night and was like, Mom, you got to watch Blue Velvet. Now, what was I possibly thinking?
How young you were.
Yeah, how young and how very immature.
Oh, naive, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I saw so many movies with my mom, and I what I think about, because it was, you would think if you had met her, it was so uncharacteristic, as I alluded to, is just the love she did have for the good action movie, you know? And I think I referenced this when we did our Die Hard Sacred Cow, but like, I whenever I watch Die Hard or hear about Die Hard, I think of her, how much she loved that movie. So again, if you knew her, probably wouldn't be your first guess. I mean, she did like the sort of period historical Tony Oscar dramas. I remember her and my dad taking me to a lot of those in the 80s for the first time, and I thought I was so grown up. So that was her thing, along with, you know, pretty much anything British or mystery. But yeah, to see her also like really, really enjoy something like Die Hard was always a blast.
Let's hear your number two 1970s movie mom.
Jillian, played by Melinda Dillon in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Now, already there may be listeners saying, what about Terry Garzrani in that movie? Perhaps, you know, also very, very memorable. I love Ronnie.
Sure.
Or what about another great Spielberg mom? Lorraine Gary's Ellen Brody in Jaws certainly qualifies for this list. But I got to say, Dillon's Jillian came to mind first. I don't know. She just strikes me as the fiercest mother in the bunch. And I love her presence in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You know, we often think of, I mean, Richard Dreyfuss is Roy Neary. He is the main character, right? So that makes sense. But really, Jillian is on this parallel journey to Roy. So they both encounter the UFOs, become obsessed with them. Mm-hmm. She then has her young son, Barry, kidnapped by the aliens. And it's interesting to me, thinking about it in the context of this list, Adam, her journey, you know, involves this desperate desire to reunite with her child, and Roy's, the father figure in this film,
desperately trying to get away,
abandoning his family, you know? Yeah. So they're on parallel tracks until they starkly divide. Now, we also think of Jillian, I think, because she's at the centerpiece of one of Spielberg's iconic set pieces. Your number one Spielberg scene, Adam, when we did that list back in 2012, and that's Barry's abduction. Beyond the filmmaking genius at work here, which we've broken down, what does Dillon do as an actor to also make it so effective? What's she contributing here? So I watched it again with that in mind, and I think I mostly appreciated how she communicates both the panic of the moment, and that's maybe her victimhood, right? But at the same time, she communicates the decisive action of her character in response. And so there's the agency. And I'm just thinking about little touches like when it looks like the aliens are coming down the chimney, she reaches her hand up there to kind of bravely pull the flue shut. picking up Barry, grabbing him tightly, trying to find a safe space in the house, and you know, even getting aggressive at that one point when she screams, "Go away," to the floor vent that starts popping up. And this is why it's so wrenching, of course, when she does let her guard down in shock for a moment, and Barry goes ahead and crawls out that dog door and gets taken. Jillian did everything she could in this scene. She's even clinging to his little legs as they disappear. And then the final shot is her running into the field, chasing that light as it fades into the cloud. So, you know, the best Spielberg set pieces work not just because of the effects or the filmmaking, but really because of the human element that's also at play. And I think that's what Melinda Dillon brings here.
I love this pick, not only because of that amazing scene, which you're right, we have talked about a lot looking at Spielberg's career, but even that first encounter with Roy on the highway, she's still chasing. You know, she knows her son has gone. In that moment, she has to imagine she's never going to see her son again. And yet, of course, she has not given up, right? She is still seeking him out. She is just as obsessive, you're absolutely right, as Roy is in his quest, except her quest is only to get her son back. So a great pick, a great movie mom. This movie mom, I don't know if we disagree about, though we do disagree about this movie, which we previously have done a Sacred Cow review of. And I'll get into the pick by saying, when you think about being a parent, I think it's fair to say that all you're trying to do really is protect your child. You just want to keep your child safe, just like Melinda Dillon's character does, especially in that scene where they come, the aliens, to take Barry away. You do everything you can to keep them safe. Anything within your means, what wouldn't a parent do? If something isn't right, you want an answer. You want to at least understand what's wrong, because then if you know what's wrong, maybe you can fix it. Well, what if you can't fix it? What if you can't understand it? What if there are no books or there's no science or any experts that can tell you what's truly wrong?
So what's wrong with her?
We still think the temporal lobe.
Oh, what are you talking about, for Christ's sakes? Did you see her or not? She's acting like she's out of her mind, psychotic, like a split personality or...
Yeah, forget aliens, Josh. Degree of difficulty factor here as a 70s mom, Chris McNeil, the great Ellen Burstyn, as Chris. She's going up against Pazuzu. You know, she's going up against the devil itself. And this is a movie that I think is about guilt, and it manifests itself in a lot of different ways and different characters, Father Karras, Father Marin, but Chris as well, because we just get hints about the family life with her and Reagan at home. We see that she's an actress, that she spends a lot of her time on set, that there's been a breakdown in the marriage, that the father is estranged. And you get through Burstyn's performance, through that character, the sense that there's this feeling of guilt that maybe she is somehow responsible or she is somehow causing this. And I found a quote today from Stephen King, who wrote in the early 80s about some of his favorite pieces of fiction in TV, movies, books that are in that genre, in horror. And he said, "The Exorcist is a film about explosive social change, a finely honed focusing point for that entire youth explosion that took place in the late 60s and early 70s. It was a movie for all those parents who felt in a kind of agony and terror that they were losing their children and could not understand why or how it was happening." And you can read the movie, and some do, as an indictment of this cultural shift and an indictment of the breakdown of these traditional norms, and thus the movie could be dismissed maybe as overly conservative. It's Chris as this improper mother somehow who has brought this, in fact, on her family and has to be punished for it. I guess I'm just a little bit more forgiving of the material and Friedkin's direction and of the movie overall as one that is tapping into that very understandable, overwhelming parental anxiety that was... Sure, I think Stephen King is right, unique to the time in which it was made, this movie coming out in 1973, but also something that is timeless and universal as a parent.
Well, first of all, you're right. I think compared to Pazuzu, the aliens in Close Encounters definitely come in peace. So I agree with you there. I also think you're really trying to provoke me with your list here. You've got two titles, Woman Under the Influence and The Exorcist. You know I have issues with. I don't, you know, my issues are not primarily with Ellen Burstyn in this movie, but I will say, and I'm not going to say much more because maybe she'll come up, but there's another Ellen Burstyn 70s movie, Mom, that I appreciate a little bit more.
Yeah, and it was right in contention for me as well, and that's why I think we're both going to bring it up as an honorable mention. Before we get there, we have our number ones.
All right, my number one is Catherine Scorsese in Italian American. This is Martin Scorsese's 1974 documentary, so this came out a year after Mean Streets did, and it mostly consists of his mother, Catherine, and father, Charles, sitting in their apartment, cooking and eating a meal, sharing memories about the neighborhood, and also their family histories as children of immigrants. This probably would have been on my top five immigrants movies in 2014 if I had seen it then. Catherine Scorsese's mother, she's the star of the show here, and that is abundantly clear. It's going to go that way from the very opening moments. She's teasing Charles for not sitting next to her on the couch, and she's totally playing to the camera.
You want, what should I say? You want me to know, you want me to tell you how my, how I learned how to make soup?
How did you learn how to make
soup? Why don't you ask me the question? Don't you hear that then?
No.
I mean, if you would ask me a question, I would answer.
I'm gonna say it now.
Right?
I want to know how you learned how to make sauce. Who taught you, who taught it to you? How long, I mean, how many years you've been doing it? And I want to see you do it.
Well, you know, when you first get married, you're really not much of a cook. I watched my mother make sauce. I watched my mother-in-law. I got a lot from my mother-in-law, a lot from the family.
She got more than my mother, from my mother than my mother.
See, there he goes, putting his mother in again.
All right, let's go inside and let's see.
So now, if you want me to show you, I'll come and show you how I make the sauce.
So I watched this, as I said, for the first time, and I thought it would probably work, but it really is a great Mother's Day movie because the two of them, as they're talking about their family histories, they spend a lot of time talking about their mothers, even their grandmothers, and just tracing this lineage. I mean, they talk about fathers and grandfathers too, but just with this list in mind, hearing them talk about the ways that these women have affected their lives and the generations that they're a part of. There's this incredible moment. Charles has just a few seconds of silence after saying, "My mother was a whip." He's talked about how tough she was and how she ran their household full of kids. I'm not even entirely sure what he means by that, but even after he expresses it, he just kind of pauses to think about what he just said. Now, why would you want Catherine Scorsese as your mom? Kind of my criteria for this whole list. Well, there's the cooking, right? And that's no small thing.
No.
There's much discussion in this movie about the essential, life-giving nature of this domestic duty, and really the challenge of fulfilling that duty if you're part of an immigrant family that has maybe 7 to 9 kids, as they talk about growing up with. And it's really touching. Catherine's recipe, actually, for sauce and meatballs appears at the end credits of Italian American.
Nice.
So stick around and you'll get that. Also, though, it's Catherine's playfulness. Not only the way she teases Charles, as I described, but the way she laughs with Scorsese, the two of them just, he's mostly off camera, but he'll walk by, very casual how he's approached this whole thing. And you see the shared dynamic that they have. We get a very early version of that great laugh Scorsese has so much in his recent documentary series with Fran Lebowitz, Pretend It's a City. We hear him laughing so much there, and you can get the early younger version of that here. Basically, though, Catherine, you want her as your mom because she's so unguarded, so honest, so funny, and she basically just tells you like it is and then gives you this shrug and lets you grow up with that information on your own to do with it what you will. You know, she's going to comes back to kind of, I think, being this overbearing or not thing. It's like, I'm your mom. I'm going to give you advice. I'm going to tell you like it is. And then, okay, now you go do what you will with it. I've done my job. So just a wonderful figure. We're probably more familiar with from her cameo in Goodfellas, I think, another dining and food scene there. But this is really a beautiful tribute to both his parents. But for this list, Catherine Scorsese.
A blind spot for me as well. One I've only seen scenes of over the years. Always been very eager to finally see the whole thing. And you're right. I, of course, do think, like I'm sure many people do, of that scene in Goodfellas. If we were talking about 80s movie moms, that scene is just special enough that she might be a contender for that list in terms of the cooking. And again, that sense of honesty that I think she was bringing even to that that role, maybe not playing too much of a role in that scene with Ray Liotta, Joe Pesci, and Robert De Niro. Great pick. My number one, well, when you haven't seen a movie in a really long time and you know you're going to struggle to come up with something insightful to say, it occasionally happens to you too, Josh, and I think we both do the same thing. We turn to the Gospel of Roger. And here's Roger Ebert, a 4-star review from 1976, the opening few paragraphs making my selection for number one 1970s movie. Mom, I said maybe my picks weren't so admirable, maybe a little bit more on the eccentric, interesting side. Here we go. Edith Bouvier Beale sits on her bed wrapped in a housecoat, surrounded by cats singing in a reverie, tea for two and two for tea. And we wonder if it occurs to her that the song is the story of the last long chapter of her life. For more than 20 years, she and her daughter Edie have lived together in a crumbling old mansion by the sea. They are surrounded on both sides by the summer homes of the wealthy, of people from their class, but Grey Gardens stands in Gothic decay. The house was beautiful once, and so were the Beals. They look through old scrapbooks, this woman of 82 and her 56-year-old daughter, and we see them when they were the cream of society. Edith on her wedding day, Edie modeling at a charity fashion show. Now a slow disintegration has set in. Rooms of their mansion and areas of their lives have been closed off, one at a time, left to the forages of raccoons and memories. Still, they've preserved a few things while abandoning so much. They still have wit, style, and what I would define as sanity. Grey Gardens, one of the most haunting documentaries in a long time, preserves their strange existence, and we're pleased that it does. It expands our notions of the possibilities. It's about two classic eccentrics, two people who refuse to live the way they're supposed to, but by the film's end, we see that they live fully in ways of their own choosing. God, Ebert was pretty good, wasn't he?
Not bad.
I also saw this quote from TCM when they played it as part of a film festival, and Albert Maysles, of course, one of the directors, along with his brother David, I think maybe was the one saying this. It's listed on Wikipedia as well, so who knows if it's true or apocryphal, but supposedly, as Big Edie, the mother, my number one choice, neared her death, Little Edie reportedly asked her mother if she had any final thoughts, and Big Edie said, "There's nothing more to say. It's all in the film." And I just am struck by that, imagining getting it that right as a filmmaker. And what I mean by that is you can find plenty of articles and essays, if you Google it, questioning whether this movie is ultimately exploitative or not, whether it's having a laugh at the expense of these characters, whether there's something grotesque and maybe even a little bit maudlin about us watching them disintegrate, to use Ebert's term. And certainly the Maysles are chronicling their lives because there is something truly weird about the way they live, something bizarre, something unconventional about them and the way they are living their lives. But to see yourself on screen and say, yep, they got it. That's it. That's me. I feel fully seen. What a remarkable achievement. Maybe that's not the achievement the Maysles were even setting out for. Maybe that's not the achievement that any documentarian should be trying to accomplish, but I still think it's an achievement here worth recognizing. And if you haven't seen Grey Gardens and you're not now encouraged to see it just based on what Ebert had to say and that notion of the Maysles' achievement, you can also just watch some amazing interactions between mother and daughter and some incredible lines, like when Little Edie says, "You can't have your cake and eat it too in life." And Big Edie says, "Oh, yes, I did. I did. I had my cake, loved it, masticated it, chewed it, and had everything I wanted." I mean, we could all be so lucky to live the way Big Edie has lived. And there's another great one, Josh, where you see truly the type of relationship they have as mother-daughter, one that is certainly codependent, maybe one that is not quite healthy. This is another one for me, Josh, a pick that's at least a half, and maybe it's a whole, because unlike some of the other mothers on this list where the relationship is one about conflict and there's something fractured, and in some cases it's trying to be repaired, here they stay together. They don't want to live apart. But that means, and this goes back to something we were talking about with another one of my picks, the honesty that is required for these two women to live together year after year.
I'm so sick of that kid. I mean, I yeah, have great pity
you know
for
the
him,
trouble.
And I like
Alice
him,
says,
but...
You know the trouble. The trouble is that he's madly in love with Edie. I said, I thought Edie was madly in love with him, on me.
He might as well leave right now, because he's never going to get it. So that's
yeah,
it.
Sex with you?
What he's after?
He doesn't want any sex with you.
Well, that's all they're after.
And that line there where... Little Edie's talking about someone on the island that she is just sure is enamored with her and wants to have sex with her. That's all they're after. And Big Edie's like, what would he want to do with you? He's not looking to have sex with you. You know, just putting her daughter completely back in her place. So, Josh, I'm going to say it. Grey Gardens may be the healthiest mother-daughter relationship or mother-child relationship I've got on my list, which is very different from yours.
Yeah, that's saying something. Absolutely. I'll begin by saying people should for sure see Grey Gardens if they haven't. It is a movie you need to wrestle with and reckon with, but you're really trolling me. Here's another one, a third one on your list that you know, I've wrestled with myself for the very reason you were talking about, that exploitative factor. And it's interesting, you know, that that quote, apocryphal or not, that you pulled out there does speak to perhaps Big Edie's feeling like this is accurate, or at least this mm-hmm. is how I want to look. You get that when yeah. you watch it, right? They're performing. They are both performing for the camera, and sure. she's happy with her performance. But it still feels different to me than the idea of feeling like you've been seen by a documentary. It feels differently than something like Agnes Varda's Faces Places, where you know the people we encountered there. Portraits, these giant portraits of them would be put up by the photographer JR, and they would see it and be moved at, you know, and mm-hmm. being recognized in that way. There's a different distinction dynamic to me going on between the two, but that's part of what Grey Gardens is about, trying to ferret out those distinctions and wrestle with them. So I think it's a great pick for this list, and definitely I think people should see it.
Those are our top five 1970s movie moms. We'll throw our moms into the mix as well, even though they never appeared on camera. I know at least one of your honorable mentions that's coming. That's Alice Hyatt, Ellen Burstyn. Alice doesn't live here anymore. Another Scorsese film.
Yep. And another single mother, right? Watching yeah. kind of the challenges that she faces as a single mom and how she handles that. Another one that I want to mention real quickly here is someone who I didn't think of immediately, but got a few nods on social media, and I think it's a good pick. It's Diana Sowell as Charlie's mom, Mrs. Bucket, in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Here's Zach Santucci. The character embodies that archetypal selfless love a parent has for their child, and Diana Sowell does it with just a look.
Completely. So, forgot about Willy Wonka.
Yeah, but you can picture her, right? When you
totally.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So those are the only two I had, Adam. I mean, like, if I wanted it to be admirable movie moms you'd like to have as your mom, I found seven. Seven in okay. the 1970s
well,
movies.
I think you could throw into the mix, potentially, if you've seen the movie, Paula McFadden, Marsha Mason in Neil Simon's The Goodbye Girl.
Okay, haven't seen it, so maybe.
Very good movie, and another single mom, Alice Hyatt, yes, on my list. I think after seeing and talking about News from Home, we would throw... Mrs. Ackerman into the mix as well. And
sure.
yes, definitely wouldn't make your list, but appropriate for mine. We mentioned it last week. Piper Laurie as Mrs. White in Brian De Palma's Carrie. Certainly memorable when it comes to 1970s movie moms. Another one, definitely not a good mom and a very small supporting turn in the movie. But Peter Bogdanovich is The Last Picture Show. I think a lot about Sybil Shepherd's character in that movie and her complicated, maybe not even love-hate, but hate-hate relationship she has with her mother in that film. So a lot of good options here, even if they're not so good mothers. Josh, we'd love to hear your picks or any other comments about the show. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. And just in case this is a topic that is really close to your heart and you enjoyed us talking about moms on screen, if you go to filmspotting.net, you can click on lists and you can look at our top five archive, where you can find top fives like mother-son movies from 2012, movie mother-daughters from 2013, or search for reviews of Bong Joon-ho's Mother, or Darren Aronofsky's Mother, or
it's been a while.
Pedro Almodovar's All About My Mother, my favorite of the bunch there, all in that Film Spotting archive at filmspotting.net. Josh, that's our show.
It is. Look at us. We programmed your viewing for Mother's Day. You are
yes,
all
we did.
Set. If you want to connect with us on Facebook or Twitter, Adam is at FilmSpotting. I'm at Larson on Film. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. And you can vote in the Film Spotting poll, who gives the best 21st century movie crime boss performance? To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop. And you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out in limited release here today, a film written by Billy Crystal, directed by Billy Crystal. And he also stars as a veteran comedy writer who's losing his memory, Tiffany Haddish, also in Here Today. About Endlessness, Josh Larson recommended for Chicagoans looking to support local venues. You can see it via the virtual cinemas of the Music Box Theater, also Gene Siskel Film Center and Facets. And in wide release, the not-so-Josh Larson recommended Wrath of Man, starring Jason Statham. Though he does recommend riding your bike to a movie theater, see anything if it's not raining. Next week on the show, we'll talk about Barry Jenkins' The Underground Railroad, which is coming to Amazon Prime on May 14th. We'll also get to the final film in our 40s noir marathon. It is James Cagney in White Heat, and we'll have our Best of the Marathon Awards.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgeren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Kat Sullivan. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.